This is Digital Story Podcast number 826, January 18th, 2022. Today's theme is Lessons in Composition, a review of the Banksy exhibit. I'm Derek Story. The Art of Banksy is touring San Francisco right now with its next stop in Denver. I spent the morning sharpening my eye, admiring the work of the famous street artist. In addition to downright enjoyable, there were many takeaways for my street photography as well. I'll share those thoughts on today's TDS podcast. So on Sunday morning, the boys treated us to an exhibit, The Art of Banksy, at the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco. And this is a show that's running there through February 27th. And then it moves on to Denver after that. And it'll be there in April, I believe. And I have a link to the exhibit in the show notes where you can learn more about Banksy if you haven't studied him a lot. I think most people are pretty familiar with him, street artist who, the girl with the heart balloon. But when you look at a whole bunch of his work in one building, and you really get to admire what he's doing with the different elements that he uses to create his art. And then, of course, you know, the satirical wit that he adds to it. There's really a lot to think about. And, you know, one of the boys said to me afterwards when we were having lunch, he was going, you know, it's interesting. I could just spend more time looking at his work than I can at the normal art exhibits that we go to. And we regularly go to museums and things like that and look at all sorts of different types of artists, everything from modern art to, you know, impressionists to Renaissance. We've seen just about all of it. And for some reason, and I tend to agree with him a lot on this, that even though the compositions are really simple with Banksy, you can just kind of linger over them for some time. So I was thinking, you know, this is great stuff for photography. And this is a theme that I've touched on before, how looking at different types of art, different types of media can help us with our own art, in our case, you know, photography. And in my case, specifically for street photography, because I think a lot of things that I see that he does, I go, wow, you know, I could apply some of that genius, right, to my own work, to my own photography. So what I thought I'd do is I'd break down a few elements of what I noticed when I was thinking about this both at the exhibit and then afterwards and share those with you so that even if you don't get to see his work. And of course, you can see it online. You can take a look and find examples of what I'm talking about. I will have one of his pieces in the show notes as well. You can take a look at it and think about what I've said and then start thinking about maybe what you could do, especially with your urban photography, you know, when you're out and about in your neighborhood or in the city or, you know, any of those places where there's people and buildings and juxtapositions and, you know, ironies, all that good stuff happening. Let's get into it a little bit here. By the way, I just want to talk about, this is a win-win-win, these sort of exhibits. And those of you that do, you know, live within driving distance of metropolitan areas, you know, in my case, it's San Francisco. It's only an hour south from me. I'm in Santa Rosa and then, you know, down to San Francisco. But the triple threat is this, you know, first, in this case, we have the location itself. And if you've ever been to San Francisco and haven't seen the Palace of the Fine Arts, you need to go. It's just really cool. It's just a beautiful place to be. You know, these large columns and, you know, the architecture is just fabulous. There's always people just sort of milling around there. So it's very good for candid photography. And then there's a little lake where there's geese and so forth hanging out, a fountain. I mean, it just sort of has everything going on. So the location itself, even if you don't go beyond there you could spend half a day just wandering around taking pictures, taking it all in. And then, of course, there's the show itself inside the palace, you know, the Banksy work, over 100 pieces. So, you know, that's another really nice thing. And then even beyond that, you know, you're right there on the edge of San Francisco. I mean, you're in San Francisco, but you're on the northern end of it. And so then you could just take off on foot and be in some very good street photography settings. So things like that are very inspiring to me because, you know, you go look at artwork and you're in a great place and, you know, and you can create your own artwork and have a bite to eat. And if the weather's decent at all, you can have a very fun day, which I did indeed. All right, so let's get back to his work specifically. You know, just by way of background, he's the artist, the street artist, and I call him a street artist, but he's been doing work in all sorts of different, you know, he doesn't just do it on the sides of buildings. He has posters and he's done magazine covers and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So he's not by any stretch of the imagination just a street artist. He's an artist, flat out artist with a very graphical style. Almost all of his work is either one color or two colors. And he uses that second color very carefully, which is something I'm going to talk about. He loves to make statements with his artwork. And, you know, so he's very much against economic oppression. He's against oppression in general. He really doesn't like that, you know, a small part of society is wasting resources while a large part of society is just trying to make ends meet. He expresses that inequity in his artwork. That's a theme that you see over and over again. He originates in Britain. And as I said, no one really knows what he looks like, or at least the general public doesn't. So he's just this fascinating person with a very sharp wit and very talented with the tools that he works with to create his art. He likes using stencils for the street art, mainly because, you know, you can create the stencil, you can sort of create the artwork, you know, in your studio. And then when you're out, because you don't want to be detected, then when you're out, you can work very quickly with a stencil, create the artwork and be gone. A lot of stuff going on with this dude. Fascinating, fascinating guy. But let's get back to the actual artwork. And there are three things that really jumped out at me that were applicable to my photography. The first thing is the power of simple compositions. I mean, if you look at his stuff, and I have it up on my screen right now as I'm talking. You look at his stuff, it's usually just, you know, a couple elements. For instance, I'm looking at right now one piece called No Ball Games, and I think this might be one that I put in the show notes. You know, it's a boy and it's a girl, and then there's a sign floating in the air. They're playing ball, but instead of a ball, it's a sign that reads No Ball Games, and then just nothing in the background, you know, just a clean background. On another one, you know, he might have a totally blue background or a solid black background with black figures, and then, you know, maybe a splash of color here or there for this or that. The Pulp Fiction piece, you know, has the two characters from Pulp Fiction. And instead of holding guns, you know, instead of pointing guns, John Travolta has a banana in his hand. So everything's black or white, and then the bananas are yellow, and that's the only place that you see the yellow. So the simple compositions, they're just very clean. They're very accessible. One of his most famous pieces of the little girl, where the balloon is floating out of her hand and the balloon is a red heart, or sometimes a blue heart or a pink heart, depending on which of the pieces you look at. And then simple background, again, you know, just a white background. And in this case, it has a black border around it, a hand-drawn black border, and that's it. So you can walk up to one of these pieces and digest them very quickly. The initial impression you can digest quickly. But the funny thing is, like my son was saying, once you've digested it, which only took just, you know, a little bit, you're still standing there. You're still standing there. Because even though it's simple, there's a lot to linger over, you know, and you're thinking about, you know, what you're looking at. And that is the fascinating part of it. And I think simple compositions in our photography can have a very similar power. You know, when you're not cluttering up the frame and when you have it down to just two or three different elements, but they're good elements, right? They're good elements. They're interesting elements. And then you have non-distracting things in the background or, you know, no background at all. For instance, in his case, it'd be no background at all. Then, you know, the viewer can digest your photograph so quickly. They can just say, wow, I just fell right into it. It was so easy. It was easy on my eyes. It was easy for me to get my head around what's going on here. Those simple compositions are very nice, but sometimes we need a few examples or a little inspiration to really understand what a simple composition is. And I think that's one of the things that Banksy reminded me of, how powerful very simple compositions can be. And I want to bring more of that to my photography. Next thing, the judicious use of color. Most Banksy works are just black and white plus one color, and that color is selected with great care, right? Again, the girl with the heart balloon, the girl is black and white. The background is white. There's a black border. There's the string to the balloon, which is black. And then there's the balloon itself, which is a red heart. That red is the only color in the composition. That little bit of red is the only color in the composition. Everything else is either black and white. Another piece here that I'm looking at called Nola. And she looks a little bit like the Morton Salt girl. And she's standing with an umbrella. And so she's black and white. The umbrella's black and white. There's a light gray background. And then the only color is the blue, which is like rain, right? Like water streaming off the umbrella. So everything else is black and white. And then the blue or the color was saved just for that one effect. And it goes, you know, on and on from there on how he does that. He really just works with black and white normally and then one color. Another one of my pieces, and it's actually one of my favorite pieces from the exhibit, it's called Stop and Search. And it has this, you know, police, military kind of police officer. And he has Dorothy from Wizard of Oz. He has her basket and he's going through her basket and Dorothy's like looking at him with this kind of distressed look on her face. Toto is in the picture too, kind of looking on like, what's going on here? Again, everything is either black or white. And then the only thing that has color here are his blue gloves, you know, the officer's blue gloves. This very restrained use of color makes it more powerful, makes it stronger, makes it really go, wow, that's really neat. And again, this is something that we can look for in our compositions. Of course, there's the technique where you change everything to black and white and then just add color to that one area. I'm not really recommending that so much. I'm talking about more finding it organically in our compositions where we look for scenes that are more monotoned, but then there's a color element that we can, you know, include in the composition to really kind of give it a little bit of punch or to make it really stand out. And again, this is something that we can think about while we're looking for our compositions in urban photography. Now, the third thing is humor and satire, how they turbocharge that effect. Of course, this is something that he just does so well. You know, so not only are the images visually appealing, but they stimulate other parts of the brain, you know, with their humor and satire. And sometimes they're sad too, you know, but the idea is that, you know, we're initially attracted to the image itself, you know, the graphical nature of the image, the clean composition, you know, the limited use of color, all these things, you know, we're pulled in by this. And then sometimes there's a punchline, right? There's a punchline and we we get the punchline, and then so a different part of our brain is stimulated, and we fall even deeper into the piece because of the wit, or, you know, because of the message that's part of the overall composition. And when you get these things working together, the simple compositions, and then you add some humor or satire or juxtaposition, as a photographer, when I think about this exhibit that I saw, it makes me ask the question, or want to ask the question, before I press the shutter button for my own work, what is this picture about? What is this picture? Before I press the shutter button and I'm lining it up in the viewfinder, what is this picture about? I should be able to answer that question. And if I can't, maybe it's about nothing. And I'm not saying that, you know, being about nothing is bad. However, if it can be about something, if it can tell a story, right? So that's that third part there. If it can tell a story, and then we can have the clean composition and, you know, this great use of color. Wow. Then we're really on to something. Then we're on to photographs and urban photography that really is a little different than a lot of the stuff that we see right now. I doubt that I'll be able to create too many images, if any, that are as engaging as Banksy works, but thinking about it and striving for that definitely is going to get me a lot closer to the mark. If you get a chance to see this exhibit, The Art of Banksy, I totally recommend it. If not, I would look up some of his work online, see what you think, think about what I said, and then see what you can do with your own camera. Apple AirTags for photographers. I published a piece on Sunday about this. I've been using the AirTags for a few weeks now, and I want to kind of give a little report on them. If you don't know what AirTags are, they're basically Find My iPhone for practically anything you want, right? They're a small disc about the size of a large coin. They fit in all sorts of little pouches and things. You can get key fobs for them, all that kind of stuff. And then you can connect them to your iPhone or your iPad or your iPod Touch. And then you can keep track of wherever that AirTag is placed. So I'm using two of them right now, and I have two more. I have a four pack. And the two of them that I'm using, I have one in my everyday blue backpack. And then another one in my Peak Field Pouch 2. And this pouch is what I've been using to carry around my Fujifilm X100V and a couple small accessories while I'm out doing my urban photography, while I'm out trying to compose images that have the power of a Banksy. It's really neat to have an AirTag in there, because that's the kind of thing that if I'm mindless just for a few minutes, I can leave behind. I can leave it sitting on a chair in a coffee shop, or, you know, leave the bag with the camera, you know, sitting on top of a rail or something while I'm, you know, talking to someone or get distracted by something else. And with the AirTag, I can set it up so that if I get too far away from it, it'll let me know right away that I've separated from this item. Or, you know, let me know where it is if I just, like, get away from it and don't hear the alert. And I go, where's my bag? Where's my bag? Well, then you just open up the Find My app and you can see right where the bag is and hopefully go back and retrieve it, right? I mean, that's the hope. But there's a certain confidence just knowing that you're going to be able to keep track of these items by using these AirTags. Now, I've seen a couple stories in the news lately, and it's been pretty interesting. One story in particular was about a fashion model who someone slipped an AirTag into her coat, I believe, while she was at a bar. She didn't see them do it. And then they were using it to stalk her, and she wasn't familiar with the message that you get at first, or she didn't hear it. Because if you have an AirTag that isn't registered to your phone's going to say, hey, there's this AirTag here. What do you want to do with it? So it'll let you know. She wasn't really familiar with the whole thing. So when she did get the notice at first, I believe she didn't really know how to interpret it. Then she figured it out that someone was trying to use it to electronically stalk her. So that's been more the news that we've heard around AirTags lately, those sorts of things. But I will say for those of us who would never use them in any way that was unethical, which is probably almost everyone listening to this show, if not everyone that's listening to this show, I'll say they're actually really practical tools. So in the article that I put on the digital story, you know, I talk about this, but then I also show a screenshot of how it looks on my iPhone, you know, when I have the Find My app up. And then I also have the steps there on how to set up the AirTag and what the minimum requirements are and all that. If you're interested in them and you want to keep track of your gear, I think they're really cool. I like using them. They're kind of fun even to use. It's easy to use. And then right away with everything else that you have in the Find My app, your iPhone, your iPad, your computers, now you have, you know, your camera gear, you know, or whatever you've done with the AirTag. I know some folks on our Facebook page mentioned that they're using it for their luggage while flying. And that was really neat to sort of know where your luggage was, especially if it got separated from you. So that's another use. There's all sorts of uses, but the bottom line is they work really well. I didn't notice any power drain at all on my device. They're kind of fun, and they're $99 for four of them or $29 for one of them. I give them a thumbs up, and if I discover anything new about them, I'll post a follow-up on our social pages. I've been talking about our Digital Story Workshop season, and I have kind of an adjustment that I'm thinking about making. So right now for the March 2022, I have Writing for Online Publishing online workshop in the schedule, but I'm toying with a change of changing that workshop to hybrid instant photography, both analog and digital. And the reason why I'm playing with that idea is that Fujifilm has come out with a camera. It costs less than $200, and it's an evolved version of cameras they've had out before that allow you to do digital shots with it and also allows you to do Instaprints with it. And the Instaprint options that you have, they have film simulations and they have print adjustments built into the camera, so that they can be these very creative things that you use on the spot. And then you can also use the camera as just a printer from stuff that's on your smartphone. And I was thinking for people who, you know, are attracted to the look of analog photography, but don't want to go through all the rigmarole of, you know, what you have to with a film camera and all that kind of stuff, or want something a bit more compact and versatile than just a regular Polaroid camera. These cameras, these Fujifilm cameras, are relatively compact, but they're quite versatile. So you have both, you know, between the iPhone or the whatever smartphone you have in your pocket and this camera, you really have a pretty powerful combination, but yet you can do analog photography right on the spot with it. So I thought, boy, that would be a really fun workshop. I've got some great techniques for instant film. The cost, you know, to get the equipment is not very much at all. And it could be something really fun to start out our workshop season. So if you have an opinion about that, let me know. You know, you can post on our Facebook page where I put this podcast. And I'm also going to put it out there for our Inner Circle members. So those of you who are a member of the Inner Circle, keep an eye on the Patreon site, and I'm going to post this question to you as well, and I'll put some details in terms of the camera and what I'm thinking about the workshop. I haven't thrown the switch yet on the change, but I'm really thinking about it. I'm really thinking about that this might be a really fun way to start out our photography workshops in the spring this year with this analog-digital hybrid approach. More to come after I get feedback from our community. The magic iPhone photo trick softened the background after the shot. This is one of my favorite iPhone photography tricks. It's not really a trick. It's just built right into the camera. I do it with my iPhone 12 Pro Max. Obviously, iPhone 13s can do it. And basically, what this is, and I have an article that explains it all. I have the link to the article in the show notes. But basically, what this is that you take a picture in portrait mode with the iPhone, using the actual portrait mode, and you can be a portrait of a person, it can be a portrait of a pet. I use it for product photography on the go, so it can be an object. And then you open it up in either Photos for iOS or Photos for macOS. And when you go to edit mode, there's a little F at the top, standing for F-stop. You can click on that in edit mode, and you get a scale where you can change the virtual aperture all the way from F1.4 to F16, and in real time, get the effect of changing that aperture in terms of the background and depth of field. And it's just really crazy. I mean, it's really wild. I mean, this is the stuff that you think, oh, wouldn't it be great to do that? You know, like we were saying this 5 years ago, wouldn't it be great to do that? And now we can actually do that. There are a couple different modes, of course, in portrait mode. There's natural light and there's studio mode. Another little tidbit about this is that if you switch to studio mode, if you didn't shoot in it, you're in studio mode, you get a different scale where you can adjust the amount of lighting going on the subject. So that's a sliding scale. And then you can click on the virtual aperture, the F, and then you can change the virtual aperture of this image to control the background and depth of field. All of this in post, and all you have to do when you shoot the shot is make sure that you shoot it in portrait mode with a modern iPhone. You can do some dynamite stuff. And like I said, I use it for on-the-go product photography as well when I'm not in the studio. I have the link to the article in the show notes, or you can just play with it based on what I said right here. But it's a great little technique. And if you have an iPhone 12, an iPhone 13, and you haven't tried this yet, you've got to do it. It's so cool. All right, let's take care of a little virtual camera club news. I want to give a big shout out to our Inner Circle members. These are the folks that support this community and this podcast month after month. As I said, Inner Circle members, I'm going to be floating a workshop idea by you. I really am curious to see what you think about this analog/digital hybrid workshop where we use this Fujifilm camera that can do all sorts of wonderful things with instant prints. So I'll be floating that by you. And then, of course, just checking in with all the normal things that we check in about. Our Inner Circle members, they're the ones that keep the terrible ads off the site, keep us content rich, and provide us with the guidance that we need so that I'm doing things and talking about things and creating events that are of interest to you, our photography community. Big thanks to them. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. It'll take you over to our site. If you like what you see, I hope you join us and become one of the elite artists supporting this photography community. Thank you so much, Inner Circle members. I think I mentioned last week that we've got the film camera shop open again. I took the month of December off when all the shipping problems and all the craziness was happening, but things have settled down a bit and the shop is open again. So if you have something, some analog gear that you think would be of interest to the people that shop at the film camera shop, then you can let me know what you have by going to thenimblephotographer.com, clicking on the contact form, tell me what you have, and if there's something that I think our audience would be interested in, I'll send you a donation kit that has the box and the prepaid label and everything. You can just put the stuff in there. Let USPS know that you have a shipment to pick up, and they'll pick it up right from your front door. A big thanks to those who have donated. I know people who really want it. I do. And they'd be so happy to have it. So just get in touch with me, and we'll take it from there. And finally, a big thanks to our friends at Red River Paper, the longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. They are the folks that have everything that we need for our inkjet printing endeavors. I'll tell you, after looking at the images that were hanging on the wall for the Banksy exhibit and some of the cool paper that they used for their printing, and just how nice it was to see framed images hanging on the wall where I could just stand there and take them in. They had very nice lighting for this exhibit. All the pieces were individually lit, and it just made me fall in love with printed work all over again. And, you know, and I was actually going, I think Red River Paper has a stock that looks just like that. You know, I'd be looking at like a matte paper that had, you know, some decent tooth to it, things like that. And they do. They have all that kind of stuff. It's not just, you know, glossy paper like, you know, you would get back in the old photo mat days. They have all sorts of very engaging matte papers, fine art papers, semi-gloss, you name it. They have it. And you can get exactly the kind of paper that works for the project that you're working on. And believe me, it is a finishing touch. It is so much different than just looking at that image on a screen, on a piece of glass, you know, a backlit piece of glass. You put it on a piece of fine art matte paper, and it's a whole different image. You can get all of that at Red River Paper. All you have to do is click on the tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. Go over to our landing page. You can nose around from there. They also have a wonderful Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. And a big thanks to them for supporting this show. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed my review of the Banksy exhibit. It was fantastic. Lots of takeaways for our photography. I'll be back with more things next week. Until then, be creative, stay safe, get out there and take some pictures. Until next Tuesday, bye-bye now.